This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Nathan Garrett grew up in Durham in the 1930s at a time when the black businesses in this city were thriving and neighborhoods were strong. He was the first student at the all-black Hillside High School to go to Yale, and he went on to command white soldiers in the Army, then went to work in Detroit, and eventually came back as a certified public accountant. When he returned to Durham in the 1960s, he got involved in the civil rights movement and helped integrate the Carolina Theater. But he found that the end of Jim Crow had unintended consequences. The quality of neighborhood schools declined, and black shop owners lost business. It had a direct impact on his father, whose once bustling drugstore struggled. Today, Nathan Garrett worries that young people don't appreciate the times he lived through, so he wrote a book. It's called A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett, and he is in the studio today with us on The State of Things. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Very pleased to be here.
Good to have you here. You were born in the 1930s, but the story of your life, as it does for so many of us, begins with your parents. Tell us about your mother and your father.
I was very fortunate. I had really wonderful parents. They were not perfect, but they were wonderful so far as I was concerned. Mother was fortunate enough to be able to be at home with the children, although she worked with Dad in special capacities at the store. She was the buyer of the exotic stuff that he sold. But mostly she was there when we went off to school, and she was there when we came back. She helped us with our homework. Wasn't a tiger mom, but she was really one that I treasured in so many different ways. My father was not there very much, but when he was there, it was clear that he was the man of the house. Mother treated him with some deference, not always proper deference, but always with some deference.
Where was the store?
The store was on Pettigrew Street. Actually, at one time, he had two stores in Durham. One was on Pettigrew, and one was on Federal Street. But Pettigrew Street is what they used to call Mexico. I know that Federal Street and really the whole area now is referred to as Haytag, but when we were coming up, the area along Pettigrew Street, which had a number of black businesses, was called Mexico.
How'd it get that name?
I have no idea, Frank.
No. And your great-grandfather was, in fact, a white slave owner. Is that right? Is it your great-grandfather?
Well, yes. Yes, on my mother's side, mm-hmm. he was the parent of my grandfather, Nathan. Mm-hmm. He was the first Nathan in the family, and there have been quite a few since that time. But at any rate, yes, he was the first Nathan, and his father was a slave owner. He was a fairly wealthy man, from what I can gather, and he had these barber shops, at least one that was downtown Tarboro, and he taught my grandfather how to, or someone did, he arranged for someone to teach him how to be a barber. So he became what is called a white trade barber in Tarboro.
Meaning he had white customers?
He had only white customers. All of the barbers in Tarboro were black. And there were three strata. One was the white trade, which was the upper class, which is what my grandfather served. And then there was the sort of the middle class or lower class white. And then there was a barbershop for blacks. And the customers for each of the strata never crossed the strata lines. So that the middle class and lower class whites never went to the upper class barbershops. And, of course, the black ones never went anywhere other than to the black shops.
How was that determined? I mean, how did you know? I guess maybe you know which barbershop to go to, but in terms of the barbers themselves, how did they get to one barbershop or another?
Well, the barbers themselves, of course, were employed at the barbershop,
right.
And they were employed based upon their ability to serve that particular clientele properly. But it's interesting, the white trade barber really was an entree for many blacks into some wealth, not great wealth, but some wealth and some status within the community. If we talk about the story of North Carolina Mutual, we all know that John Merrick was himself a white barber, a white trade barber. In Tarboro, where my grandfather was, my maternal grandfather again, he became very instrumental in a number of civic activities. He back in the early 1900s, he was a member of the school board in Tarboro. Now, he was there in order to, I guess, have his input with regard to the colored school for Tarboro, which was really over in Princeville. But the fact that he was there and he was meeting customers or serving customers who were influential, the fact that that they sometimes provided entree into a lot of different things. There's an interesting story in the book about my grandfather. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it involved my grandfather and the Klan, where he got word somehow that the Klan was not happy with the fact that he had this store on Main Street, and he sort of, they sort of wanted to, really to replace him with a different barber. And they had this rally and were going to come and burn out his house, etc. He learned about it through a very unusual way. He looked himself like a white man, and he went to the Klan rally. This is according to one of my cousins who said he was there at the time. He went to the Klan rally, discovered that they were planning to burn his house down, arranged for his two sons who were in New York at the time to come down with guns. They sat on the, they stood on the front porch and warned one of the Klansmen not to light that torch that he was carrying. The man did. One of the sons shot the man. Turned out the man was a deputy sheriff. When he went to court the next morning, or the Monday morning, the judge, who was a customer of my grandfather's, decided that, young man, you need to leave Tarboro and never come back. And that's exactly what happened. That particular cousin, his name was Julian, left and went to Detroit, and he never came back to Tarboro for any reason whatsoever. His father's death, his mother's death, nothing ever brought him back.
It's interesting to think of what might have happened had your grandfather not been a barber of some standing in the white community.
It is interesting to contemplate that.
So this becomes, as you suggest, this is a way to cross the barrier, and at least for some African Americans. Did your grandfather own the business? Was it his business, or was he working for a white barbershop owner?
The barbershop was actually owned by his father, who himself was not a barber. He had no business in the business, but yes, he actually did work for his father in that business.
Who in this case was white.
Right. Now,
and what about that in terms of your family dynamics, having a former slave owner in the family, a white a patriarch in the family? What did that do to the dynamics of your family, if anything?
Frank, as far as I know, there was never any interaction between that white grandparent and the rest of the family. I never heard my mother talk about having any contact whatsoever with whoever that man was. As a matter of fact, the family is not even sure what his name was. It's interesting, though, that my mother never talked about these things. Most of what I got for the book that I wrote came from my father and his older sister, Aunt B, and from really a cousin on the Williams side. But what she had gotten from her mother, who was my mother's sister, my aunt, of course. And it's interesting that my mother simply did not talk about these things. So all the time I was growing up, I heard from my father lots about his side of our family, but she never volunteered anything. Hmm. So I really don't know. That was not a source of information for us.
And you had an aunt and uncle who could pass for white.
Yes.
And there was some tension there about whether or not that was ethical and whether or not that was the right thing to do.
Right. The whole family looked white. If you had a copy of my book, if the readers did, they would see that picture looked as though it was a picture of a totally white family in America. My father, his wife, all of the children simply looked white. That's all. But yes, my mother was kind of a, not a rebel, but she was high-spirited, and she felt very strongly about the issue of race. And as a matter of fact, she was a valedictorian of her class at St. Augustine, and she gave the valedictory speech. And fortunately, I was able to get a copy of it because it was written up in the News and Observer at that time. And the speech talked about the need to end segregation, all the things that were wrong with it, talking about this is 1919, about the soldiers coming home and things needing to be different and so forth. So she gave a very high-spirited speech, which the superintendent of instruction felt strongly enough about to go up after she spoke to rebut what she said. And
wow.
That was reported in the News and Observer.
So
I've got the whole exchange, and
wow.
it's recorded in the book.
Why do you think she was reluctant to talk about her family?
I never talked to her really about it. I just knew that that was, other than knowing Grandfather Nathan and knowing her sisters and a couple of her brothers, I just never got information from her about it. And that's one of the things that that sort of prompted me to write the book, because I felt that I was fortunate enough to be able to interview my father and his older sister and to get information that I otherwise would not have had. And I wanted to encourage others to do the same thing. African Americans do not do enough writing. We need to tell our own stories. In my case, parts of my life have been recorded in about 5 different books now and several national articles, but they were never told exactly to my satisfaction. So I concluded that, well, if my story is to be told, I should write it myself. It might not be totally accurate, but it's the way I remember it.
Nathan Garrett tells his story in his memoir, A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett, and our conversation on the state of things will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking with Nathan Garrett, author of A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. So we talked about your family's history in Tarboro. You were born there, but really grew up in Durham. What brought the family from Tarboro to Durham?
Well, Frank, it was the Depression. It was 1933 when my father concluded that he could not really support a family of 4 children and a wife with the income that he could earn from his drugstore there in Tarboro. So he decided to move, and I think he really was very seriously considering Winston-Salem, and I think the reason for that was because of the fairly high level of employment among black people in the tobacco industry there in Winston-Salem. There was no such thing in Tarboro, and although the Tarboro economy had fared fairly well with peanuts and cotton, and it really was an important trade center, the fact was that the Depression really hit Tarboro and all of eastern North Carolina very, very hard indeed. And he felt that Winston-Salem, with its tobacco industry, which was not hit as hard, might be good. But he also visited Durham. And in Durham, first of all, he met the medical director of North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, who was a physician who had a practice and who also happened to have a vacant store because there had been a pharmacist in the store in the Biltmore Hotel, which Clyde Donnell owned. That's the name of the physician. And he talked Dad into considering seriously leasing that store from him. But Dad also looked at the fact that in Durham, unlike any place else he'd ever seen, there were more African Americans in business for themselves than he had found anywhere, even heard of, even when during his days in Washington. That's Washington, D.C.
Right.
We had, for instance, starting at where my father's drugstore was on Pettigrew Street, that was the Biltmore Hotel, which was a 3-story edifice with a restaurant and things of that sort. There was a movie theater next door, the Regal. Next to my father's store was a man who ran an oil distributorship, as well as a distributorship for Coca-Cola products and other things of that sort. And going on up, you had another movie theater ultimately that was developed called the Booker T, about 2 blocks away. There was a printing company. There was a newspaper. Mm. There were service stations that really could do a good job of repairing cars. There was a construction company. All these things were right there in Durham, so that there was a high level of employment for African Americans, not just at the tobacco plants, but also from businesses that the race actually owned.
A real chance at business ownership.
That's exactly right.
And all of this, much of this, doesn't it go back to the presence of North Carolina Mutual as a financier and the Farmers Mechanics Bank?
Right. Mechanics and Farmers Bank, North Carolina Mutual, and Mutual Savings and Loans, so that these businesses had outlets or opportunities to get mortgages for homes. There was a high level of home ownership. And for an entrepreneur, very often the home is a great source of equity, because if you build it up over the time and the market values go up, not like we had recently with the bubble that burst, But that becomes a source for loans that could help a business over tough times. So that if it was a need for, if there was a need for working capital loans, my father very often got working capital loans from Mechanics and Farmers Bank. And the mutual was also a source of loans for, well, for structures, for homes and for churches and that sort of thing. So, yeah, that was an important thing. And then you had to add to that the existence of North Carolina, what is now North Carolina Central University, which meant that you had a class of people who were fairly stable in their employment and had income to spend. And there were also there was also a beauty college. Madame DeShazer ran that, and there was a barber college. So just all these things meant that my father concluded, yeah, we can make it in Durham.
It's one of these subtle kind of paradoxical questions, too, about under segregation with black-owned businesses. First of all, it's important to have the financing. If there's money not flowing through a neighborhood, if it's choked off for any reason, you won't see any development at all. So where you see it, there's development. But under segregation, there were opportunities for black-owned businesses to cater to a black clientele.
Oh, absolutely. The start of Mechanics and Farmers Bank, the start of North Carolina Mutual, really, you have to say, was because of the segregated society. Mm-hmm. In terms of life insurance, if you could buy a life insurance policy, if you were a worker or laborer and you were black, if you could buy a life insurance policy from Metropolitan or one of the big companies, it was rare. None of them had any policies that you would call preferred risks. So when North Carolina Mutual came into existence, it served a real need in that community. In other words, when people died, there was a source of money for burial, or for sending a kid to college, or to help pay off the mortgage. And this was something that was made available because North Carolina Mutual was there. Mechanics and Farmers Bank, the same thing. It had problems. All of them do. But you think about Mechanics and Farmers Bank and the fact that it had depositors who were not wealthy, who were struggling every day to make ends meet. But Mechanics and Farmers Bank was able somehow to keep track of all of those accounts, even though they were small. And it costs you as much to keep track of a small account as it does to keep track of a large one. But anyway, those institutions were absolutely essential for the success of Durham.
And you went to public schools here.
I certainly did, and enjoyed them thoroughly. I had great teachers. I felt that I learned later on that perhaps at that time in Durham, at least, I can't say for the rest of the state, but in Durham, at least, it seemed that the teachers that we had at grade school, right on through junior high and high school, were probably better prepared than the white teachers. The reason for that was that if you were looking for a job as a professional or a career as a professional back then, the ones that were available to minorities was to be either a minister or a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher. And those were the ones that were highly revered. So that what happened was that these teachers who got their teaching certificates tended to continue to get their education and stayed on the job. Whereas in the white community, because there were many more opportunities, you may have had good teachers moving into the school system, but very often they moved on when better opportunities for pay and other opportunities were presented. So the black teachers tended to stay, and I got the benefit of that.
You did, and to the extent that you were able to get into Yale from Hillside.
Yes, I did, and that was a very interesting process of getting accepted and a very interesting process of matriculating at Yale. The reason I went to Yale was because my father, back in Princeville, had a teacher, his name was William Augustine Perry, who had graduated from Yale and had a PhD from Harvard, a black man. And he came back south because his father, actually he was there in Tarboro and Princeville because his father was a very influential Episcopal priest there. At any rate, my father was so impressed with that teacher, this would have been about 1905 to 1908, that he decided then, he told me, that when he had a son that he felt was capable, that he wanted him to go to Yale. So when I applied to school, I applied to Howard, which is where I wanted to go to school. Duke was not out of the question. When I was ready for Duke, Duke was not ready for me. But I knew I had to apply to Yale, and I did so. I took the entrance examination and so forth. And apparently I did well enough to get in. And when I got the acceptance letter, I actually cried because I really wanted to go to Howard.
Oh, you really? Oh, it was a disappointment to you.
To me at the time, yeah. Right.
Well, you say Duke was out of the question, obviously segregated, was not going to, did not permit African Americans. How prepared was Yale for you? You must have been one of very few African Americans.
I was a member of the largest class, I understand, that had ever been recruited of African Americans to Yale at the time. There were four of us. Hmm. There were four of us in a class of 1,500. When I got there, I learned that the other three, whom I did not know, were there, and one was from, I think, Charleston, one was from Cincinnati, and one was right there in New Haven. They were living together on old campus. They had not known one another before Yale, but Yale put them together for, I guess, whatever reasons they did. For some reason, however, I didn't get put in that group. I got put out in what were barracks, really, that had been there from the V-12 program. It's a Navy program after the war. And when I walked in the room with my bags, I met my roommate. His name was Robert Bias Ward from Dallas, Texas. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and there was this pregnant pause. And finally, he jumped off the top of the bunk and came down and shook my hand, helped me with the bags, and we never had any problems.
In general, what was it like for you fitting in as an African American, as a Southerner, in New Haven, Connecticut?
Well, in New Haven, what I learned was that the sophistication and the participation in business and professions among the African Americans in New Haven was nothing like I had grown up with in Durham. That was the first thing. But then I also met a lot of people in the New Haven community who were doing things that Black folks in Durham were not doing. For instance, Jack Harris, who was one of the four who were in that class who was from New Haven, his father was a chemist. And the only chemist I'd ever known was a chemist who taught at North Carolina College. So the idea of there being a chemist who was actually being a chemist with a job as a chemist in a firm there in New Haven was something brand new to me. So it opened up a lot of things to me. I'd never met any Black Catholics. I'd never met a Puerto Rican. Never knew any Jewish people. Nothing. It was just a wonderful experience for me.
What were your ambitions? What were you planning to do with that Yale education?
Well, my father had some real strong ideas. He wanted me to go to medical school eventually, and at that time, the plan was in medical school that if you're in undergraduate school, don't major in science. Major in things that like psychology or like English or history or things that were available at a liberal arts college that you couldn't get in med school because they figured they could teach you all the science you needed once you got into med school. So my major, instead of being science, was psychology. That's what I happened to select. As it turned out, I would have made a lousy physician. I'm still bothered by the sight of blood, so that was really not for me.
It crosses you right off the list. So,
right.
So when you got out then, you went into the Army.
Went into the Army, went down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and that was a great experience. What had happened was that after I had graduated from college in June of, I guess it was 1952, for some reason, they did not grab me as they were doing other people as soon as they finished college. You had this deferment if you were in college. But either they overlooked me or somebody forgot about me, and I knew that my life was really on hold because I had to go to the military. And so eventually I went down in October and says, well, look, what are you going to do? Because I can't stay in limbo forever. And they said, oh, yes, we're going to induct you. And I did so in November.
Because the Korean War would have been going on.
The Korean War was going on at that time. And because I went in November, there were only two other people who had college training in my group. because the college kids generally went in June and July, you know, right after graduation. So what we had was a company that was filled with people from Appalachia, black and white. Most of them had probably an eighth or ninth grade education max. And I said, oh, my Lord, this is going to be horrible. And then what happened was that they took – I was there for 16 weeks of basic training. And they took all of the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants and the corporals and so forth, and sent them all out to Korea because that's what they right. – the way they were needed. So they made the three of us, me and two white guys, acting platoon sergeants. And I said, this is really going to be a problem now. But, you know, Frank, I never had a moment's problem that I knew of. There may have been people who resented me, but I was actually a sergeant so far as they were concerned. They did what I told them to do, when I told them to do it, how I told them to do it. And it just, it all worked very, very well.
How long did you do that?
For the full 16 weeks of basic training.
16, wow. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the military hadn't been integrated long. I mean, 4 or 5 years by
then,
right?
Exactly right.
So,
that's exactly right.
So they hadn't had much time to adjust. But you said you didn't sense any overt hostility anyway.
No overt hostility.
You had stripes, though. There was that. So that does help a little bit. So then it's off to Detroit right after that. Tell us about that and what you were planning to do. Your undergraduate degree was in psychology.
Right. And I had thought about my life a lot and decided that I really wanted some area of business as a career. I didn't want pharmacy because it was too restricting. I'd seen my father go to the drugstore at 9 o'clock in the morning and come back at 11 o'clock at night with one day off, one evening off on Thursdays. And I said, well, pharmacy is really not for me. But I liked the business end. He had let me as a 16-year-old really run the front end of the store. And I enjoyed that so much. He taught me about taking inventory. He taught me about being good to the customers. He talked about the pricing and all the things that were necessary in order to run a successful front end of the store. And I guess I must have been a fairly good manager. Anyway, that was an experience that I enjoyed immensely, and I decided I wanted some area of business. So when I got to Detroit, first of all, I shopped for a whole lot of jobs that simply weren't there for me as an African-American. One was with the Chrysler Corporation. One was with the Bell Telephone Company there. A lot of turndowns simply because I was an African-American. I was not making progress.
Were you prepared for that in Detroit? You're in
no.
the North. It's the mid-50s, early
no,
50s.
No, I did not realize that segregation was strong and well in Detroit. And it was a real shocker to me.
Did it feel different to you than it felt? Certainly you must have sensed it here in Durham as well.
Yeah, the thing about Durham, you got segregation of the South, Jim Crow, et cetera. You know what the rules are. In a place like Detroit, you never knew what the rules were. Sometimes you would go to a place and they welcomed you with open arms. Other times you were not. And you just never knew which one you were going to get. So you were always on tenterhooks as to what to do, when, and how. But at any rate, the job prospects were not good at all. And frankly, that's one of the things that drove me into the numbers racket, which I write about in the book. One of the people who read it said that, wow, they'd always wanted to know a great deal about the numbers racket, and now they know.
Well, and you got to have a head, so you should tell us a little bit about that. But you're in Detroit, and it's this gambling business, right?
Yeah, it was. And there's no justification for me having gone into it. The fact that I did not have a job did not mean that I should have embraced a career, even a part-time job, in an illegal activity. But I did. So I was weak in that regard. And I was so lucky that I got out of it when I did. But the numbers racket was run by people who were really ordinary folks. As a matter of fact, they had to use very good business principles in running the numbers business.
It's a lot of keeping track, right?
It's a lot of keeping
yeah.
track. They had accounting issues. They had morale issues. They had to make sure that the employees felt good about their job, so they'd have parties for them and gatherings of various sorts, including the families. When somebody was ill, they made sure that the family was taken care of. They didn't have sick pay policies, but they took care of it. So, yeah, it was a very interesting experience.
You learn a lot about the job hunting prospect, too. There's a story you tell about – I'm gonna hold this story because we're right up against a break. We're going to come back, take a look at how the job search went in Detroit, a little bit about your rough moment at Chrysler, and then we'll get you back here to Durham and talk more about that as my conversation continues with Nathan Garrett, author of A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. And just ahead, we're getting Nathan's opinions, too, on the future of historically black colleges and black businesses. All of that on the state of things when we continue. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Nathan Garrett, author of A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. You're talking about the way segregation or racism worked in the North. The rules were a little bit different, but you learned pretty quickly that there was a real process for sorting out African Americans in the whole application and interview process. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the interviews I had was with Chrysler. I figured that with that Yale degree in psychology and so forth, I would be good for somebody there or something. And I had this interview. They really allowed me to get to up to the level where I think they probably were taking interns or that sort of thing. And I had this interview, and one of the questions that was asked in the interview was, you know, Mr. Garrett, we're making these automobiles, but our own employees don't buy them. What would you recommend that we do? I hadn't the foggiest notion. When I thought about it for a while, I said, well, if they're not buying the cars, maybe they ought to make a better car. But I said, that's not going to go over very well. So I then, my mind turned to the fact that, well, maybe they needed to have their employees identify more with the end product. And maybe instead of having everybody work at one little niche or one little area of the assembly line, they ought to allow people to see what the whole process is like and maybe have some some pride in the product that was being developed. Well, that didn't impress him either. Anyway, I never got a call back, and so it was wasted time.
You also found, I guess, that there were tests that probably only African Americans had to take.
Yes, at the Bell Telephone Company, they gave me a test that was, I suppose, I had to pass in order to get a job there. And one of the questions, there were many ridiculous questions on it, but one of the questions was, how many newspapers are there in the United States? And I could not understand and still cannot understand what that has to do with being in the executive training program or something of the sort at Bell. And I had not any notion, but I'm sure I did very poorly on the test, and that's probably what they wanted to have. But, you know, Frank, that was not we had the same problem and have had that problem quite some time, up until the time that we actually had civil rights legislation trying to protect people in jobs, achieving a job, right, and maybe even moving up. Duke Power Company, for instance, there was a big case on that where the employees who were African-American had not ever been able to move above a certain level, usually the level of labor or shop cleaner or something of the sort. And what some sharp lawyer did was to say, well, the reason for that is this test that Duke Power is giving to everybody. And when they looked at the test, what they discovered was that the test was really a test to see how much of high school one had mastered. But the test had nothing to do with the skills and abilities you needed in order to succeed in many of the jobs above the menial level at Duke Power. And that was one of the early cases where Duke Power finally relented, and they had an affirmative action program because it was clear that the reason there had not been any African Americans above a certain level to Duke Power was because of the test, and the test was not a valid test for the purposes of which it was being used. Same was true with Michigan Bell. Thanks to the equal employment opportunity legislation, those things are harder for a not willing employer to use.
And you came back to Durham just in time to see the civil rights movement in full bloom or come into its full momentum.
Yes. Wanda, my wife of 52 years, and I moved back. She's a native Detroiter, and I had to fight her brothers they were trying to influence her not to come back with her new husband. But at any rate, she showed more faith in me than I think anybody ever had because she decided she would take her chances and coming back to little old Durham, North Carolina. This was in 1962. And yes, the civil rights struggle was beginning at that point. And I had some interesting experiences. When I was trying to build my practice, I had very few clients. All of them were African-American. And this one white woman came to me who, her name was Maggie Dent. She was older than I was. She was from New York, upstate New York. And she had opened up an arts film theater on Main Street called the Rialto. And she, I guess she was steered toward me by some African-American friends that she had. I didn't know who she was. But at any rate, as it turned out, and at that time I was leasing space in the office of Floyd McKissick.
You had gotten your CPA certificate.
I had gotten my CPA certificate in Detroit in 1961 and moved back here in 1962. So I was practicing in an office that I leased space from, in Floyd McKissick's office on Main Street. And he and I were sharing all things in the office, including his receptionist and his conference room. But at any rate, Maggie Dent has this theater, wants me as her accountant. Well, as it turns out, the NAACP Commandos, this is a youth group within the NAACP, were at that time picketing the Carolina and the Center theaters, trying to get them to integrate. And they decided that they should picket the Rialto Theater as well. And they started picketing. Well, my client came to me and says, can't you do something? Can't you help me? And so forth. So I said, well, sure, we'll sit down with Floyd McKissick, who was really the advisor to the Commandos, and we'll talk it over. So we went to our conference room, Floyd's conference room and mine. I sat on one side of the table with Maggie, and he was on the other with the youth of the Commando group. And I said to Floyd, this woman does not want to run a segregated theater. She would like to integrate it. But she's got a lease, and I saw the lease, that said for any reason or no reason at all, I can remove all of my equipment from this theater. And she was told the reason for that provision in the lease was that if she integrated, it would put pressure on the owner of the lease, of the equipment, I'm sorry, who happened to be the person who owned the Carolina Theater, who was also being picketed at that time. Okay. And he says, if you allow integration, then it'll put more pressure on me. So if you do it, I'm going to remove all the equipment. Wow. Maggie went out. She's very resourceful. Found some middle-income black people, some middle-income white people who believed in racial justice and so forth, got them to sign a pledge to give her or lend to her $10,000, which at that time would have been enough to replace all of that equipment. And she went to the owner of the lease and said, look, I'm going out of business if this picket continues. So I'm going to integrate my theater. And if you want to take your equipment, do so. I've got this pledge. These people have pledged to give me $10,000 and showed him the evidence of it. And I will buy new equipment. Well, I guess the guy thought, well, gee whiz, he didn't have any place to store that stuff. He was going to lose the revenue from it. And what the heck, he capitulated.
Wow.
And so, that was the first theater to be integrated in Durham.
A fascinating story, because here you have social capital and financial capital coming together
to
make social justice happen.
That's exactly right.
And not only that, but it also indicates this other relationship we may not have known about. I mean, what seems to be a competitive business, two competitive businesses are really integrated themselves financially. In other words, if I'm leasing you the equipment, well, it's fine with me if you go to the Rialto if I'm running this other business.
So that's exactly right.
Fascinating insight into how all of that worked. You were involved in that, and then you also became part of the North Carolina Fund with an agency that you started.
Yes, the North Carolina Fund was funded by the Ford Foundation, the Z. Smith Reynolds, and the Mary Reynolds Babcock Foundations over in Winston-Salem. It got the funding because Terry Sanford, bless his heart, felt that he wanted to do something about the extent of poverty in North Carolina, and his motto was to break the cycle of poverty. And I'm told, I was not there at the time, that Terry went to the Ford Foundation and says, look, I don't want your money, I want your ideas, because you're running programs in various parts of the country called the Gray Areas Project, and we just like to know what things we can do in North Carolina. Well, this so impressed the Ford Foundation that he came home not only with their advice, but with their money, a little over $5 million that was committed to the North Carolina Fund at that time. George Esser was the executive director, a tremendous man. He'd been at the Institute of Government for many years, a lawyer, Harvard lawyer, as a matter of fact. And I think George was actually a member of the Jefferson family from Virginia. Mm. But at any rate, one of the people on that board that had been put on that board was a guy by the name of John Hervey Wheeler, who was an African-American who was president at that time of Mechanics and Farmers Bank. I'd gotten to know John Hervey because I needed him for my banking needs, but he also had been really a mentor to me and had referred a lot of clients my way because those people needed financial statements that they could not prepare, and so it was a great mix. But John got really impressed with my ability and recommended to George Esser that he look at me as a possibility to control the finances for the North Carolina Fund. And I talked to George Esser and took him on initially as a client, but then realized how important the work was and really got consumed by it and just went and did that full time and put my practice on hold, so weekends, holidays, etc. That was a great experience. The North Carolina Fund had a really power board. Not only did you have Terry Sanford, but you had banking executives, you had news media executives, you had Hargrove Bowles, the father of it called him Skipper Bowles, the father of Erskine Bowles, people who were really strong and who really had their hearts in the right place. They wanted to make changes in North Carolina, but they wanted these changes to occur because people's hearts changed or people found out that there was a different way to go about employment and education and health and so forth that could benefit people who were underprivileged, but also not hurt, you know, the ruling class, in other words. Mm-hmm. So it was evolution, not revolution. I worked at that initially as the controller, then moved up to deputy for finance and administration, and ultimately to deputy director for all purposes. And while I was deputy director for all purposes, a couple of events occurred. We were doing community organization. There were these 11 community action agencies that were being supported by the North Carolina Fund. Incidentally, they all were created before the War on Poverty by Johnson and all became community action agencies, would have to have been among the first in the nation when the Office of Economic Opportunity was created. Well,
the North Carolina Fund was in way the model for that
it
war
was
on poverty.
It was very much that way. But because they were doing some community organization in Durham and in an area called, Chonoke Area Development Association was in Northampton, Hertford, Halifax, and Bertie counties. There you had indigenous organizations of people who were trying to address things like a lack of sanitation in their communities, a failure to enforce housing codes, jobs, all the issues that any underprivileged community is faced with. At any rate, this was going on, and there were these two organizations that began to lobby very hard to get independent funding so they could pursue their purposes without having to go through these community action agencies. Well, Operation Breakthrough in Durham was willing to see this happen. They were very pleased with the work of Ben Ruffin and Howard Fuller for a while at that time, who were really the community organizers. But at any rate, what happened was that we had this sort of crisis within the North Carolina Fund, and all of the black employees pulled together and decided that it was time for the North Carolina Fund to actually provide funding directly for these black-controlled organizations in their communities. And that was a tough decision. Judge Esser, bless his heart, presented the proposition to the board. And he did so because, first he allowed me to make the proposition, and I failed. They had a great deal of respect for me, but not nearly the respect they had for George Esser. George Esser made the case beautifully, and Terry Sanford and others agreed that, the North Carolina Fund is still about evolution, and this is closer to revolution, but we see that its time has come. And so they agreed to create a spinoff organization called the Foundation for Community Development, if I would head the program and develop the proposals and so forth for it. I had that reputation of being a level-headed, good administrator, but also somebody who was very much concerned about the plight of the Black community. And they felt that I had the balance and skills necessary to run that organization so that it wouldn't, in their terms, get overtaken by some rabble-rousers and some people who were not really responsible.
But in a way, this is a fundamental shift. So even if you're not using radical rhetoric, it means that that elite, that those who are in control right now, are going to have to truly share power.
That's exactly right.
And that's fundamentally different than what the North Carolina Fund had in mind.
That's exactly
at first.
Right.
Things change. How did they change? And
well, we went about the process of community organization all over North Carolina. There were about 7 or 8 different organizations in addition to the one in the Chonok area and the one in Durham, for which we provided funding. And what we focused on, Frank, was leadership development. We would go in, we would have our agents go in and do a job of trying to talk to people and bring them together into small groups and to discuss what their problems were and what they thought were the answers to those problems. And out of that process, some indigenous leadership, some people who the people themselves trusted, sort of surfaced. And then we would provide training for those people so that they then could become full-time employees of an organization that we would fund in order to pursue these issues. And in addition to all the things that I talked about, housing, education, jobs, and so forth, almost every one of those communities was also concerned with the fact that there was a paucity of services in their communities. No drugstores, no grocery stores, no service stations, and so forth. And they really wanted to see some of these enterprises created in their communities. And that led to the two-pronged approach that we had within the Foundation for Community Development. One was the community organization around social issues, and the other one, growing out of the same community organization, was economic development.
Nathan Garrett, I sure wish we had more time. Pleasure talking with you. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nathan Garrett is the author of A Palette, Not a Portrait, Stories from the Life of Nathan Garrett. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. You can check us out on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Our interns are Nasser Abbas and William Kumpf. Robin Copley is our technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.